afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
He finally came back.
Came back from the dead.
Still got the shingles. We won't even get into that. They suck, though, if you haven't had the shot. I'm not big on shots, but after watching Bill is a great advertisement for the shingles vaccine. We're changing it up today. We have Julian Hagman on here for the first half hour, and he is the Chief Operating Officer of Caring Professionals, Inc. I'll just roll with, he's got a very long bio, but the interesting part is the whole thing, so I'll just read part. A driven and results-oriented healthcare executive with more than a decade of experience in strategic planning, business development, and organizational growth. As the CEO at Caring Professionals, a licensed home care agency, and fiscal intermediary, he oversees operations that deliver essential services to older adults and individuals with disabilities. His mission is to evaluate business performance, enhance service quality, and maximize productivity across all departments while ensuring strict compliance with state regulations and industry best practices. Now I'm going to skip to the recent part. Recently testified before the New York State Joint Committee of the Senate Standing Committee on Health and the Senate Standing Committee on Investigations and Government Operations on concerns regarding the mandate for single fiscal intermediary and its impacts on the consumer-directed personal assistance program, CDPAP. I didn't know that acronym. So it's the Consumer-Directed Personal Assistance Program. And I'll tell you what, everybody, I can't imagine unless you're 10 years old, everybody's dealing with, knows somebody who's dealing with, is the person who's dealing with senior care these days. And the title of this kind of got my eye, the thing that came out from his publicist, New York's powerful 1199 SEIU union already benefiting from Governor Hochul's allegedly rigged revamp of the $11 billion Medicaid program. Yeah, well, $11 billion, yeah, I mean, there's
that's
like,
worth taking a run at.
Yeah, might as well. So, Julian, that, except for what I've posted online for today, that's the end of our portion of the program, so.
That's the Cliff Note version,
right.
You know, the $11.99 piece, unfortunately. That's typically where I would start also, right? The union, you know, what the benefit they actually bring versus the cost.
Yeah.
Right? We're talking about family caregivers here.
Yeah.
Right? We're not talking about an Amazon warehouse. We're not talking about, you know, any kind of major productivity kind of establishment. We're talking one-on-one care, one employer, one employee. I don't know why the union would think they can come in and, you know, demand better benefits for that one employee on the behalf of the individual, especially in a state that is so regulated that, you know, healthcare is law, minimum wage is the highest in the country. There's a healthcare minimum wage on top of standard minimum wage. What's the union really bringing here? And yet they're going to profit, you know, $200 million or so. That doesn't seem...
Which drives up the cost again.
Everything drives up the cost. But in the grand scheme of things, the $200 million, the union's benefit is peanuts.
Sure.
Right?
If there's $11 billion on the table, sure.
But the whole situation really at our hands, it started with the no-bid contract, between the current administration and... You know, on the face of, you know, saying we need to ensure economies of scale and efficiencies, right? It's the typical private equity sort of terminology coming in and trying to scale, you know, a corporation through efficiency. And I keep trying to explain to them that, you know, you're talking about individuals and communities across the state of New York that are going to be, you know, locally affected by removing these individuals from those communities. But they didn't really seem to care about that because there was a bigger price tag on the other side that was much more lucrative, apparently. Obviously I've been very involved throughout the whole entire process. But like you said, it's $11 billion a year program. The profit on that is $1 billion to this now state-sanctioned monopoly, right? Before you had 600 local companies that were providing this care throughout the state. So 600 local providers had shut their doors as of April 1st. And this was the only company that was legally allowed to provide this service.
Oh, gee, for the entire state?
For the entire state.
And how do they figure that's going to control costs when they appoint who gets the contract and
there's no competition?
There's no competition.
I'm very happy you brought that up because most recently, so even the payers, right? Because the state, as you know, contracts out its Medicaid program to different insurance carriers. Right, so the Anthem, Blue Crosses, Blue Shields, the Molinas, Health First, what have you, right? They are all contracted out by the state, and this is all run through the Medicaid program. They are a part of a healthcare association who has legal representation, who just most recently submitted a letter to the company that won the bid's attorney, you know, calling on them because they are now trying to increase their reimbursement. After last year's contract was finalized, within 6 months, they're coming back and saying that they're demanding higher reimbursement. And so, the association's coming out and citing all these antitrust rules and basically calling it a monopoly. Even though, I was there shouting, holding the flame and shouting, this is a monopoly, state-sanctioned monopoly a year ago. Now it's, really becoming seen because the insurance players are now getting involved, and they're seeing, okay, well, if I don't provide them higher insurance rates, they can cut me out of the system. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Wow. What a neat trick.
Yeah, and, additionally to that, because there's always more, which I love, because, everything that is done prim and proper, right, the stories obviously keep coming out, and so there's a watchdog organization called the Empire Center in New York State. They most recently came public with a FOIA request in which they received. On the FOIA requests was listed just names and emails of the individuals who were parts of this meeting, which happened in April before the budget came out. And on that email is, the Medicaid director for New York State. It's members of the executive's team, the chief operating officer. There's members of the company that won the what was going to be an RFP, but was not public knowledge that there was going to be an RFP at that point, who were in this meeting. So we got that they've had meetings and they have had follow-up meetings prior to that budget coming out. But, the funny thing is we also have testimony by these very people saying that they had no communication prior to the budget coming out.
Oops.
So, so now we're in the situation, it's like, well, that's interesting. So what's really going on here? So, I could go on and on and on because this is just the most recent development, right? This FOIA we got, this past week. It goes back to even further, right? There was backroom deals and budget negotiation. The fact that you could rip, the foundation out of these programs, out of these communities, I don't know. I know many people are familiar with, senior care. But whether you're in the city, whether you're in rural, right, we're sometimes the agency that's most easy to get in touch with and understands your direct need, whether it's language, dialect, religion, creed, what have you, even where you are in the state. And You know, all these businesses are gone. Thousands of employees throughout the state were laid off. I had to lay off 60% of my staff. It's really a disgrace.
And these were all people who provided direct care to seniors in their homes.
That's the program.
For the most part.
The program. Yeah, well, that's the program. The program is the direct care piece. But to support that program, because what this company is doing, what the state did is they hired a private equity company. Right? This is owned by private equity through and through. And what do? They want to make it as efficient as possible to drive up the valuation. And so to do that, you need to reduce costs. How do you reduce costs? Everything is done offshore. All right? How do you provide a local service? This is home and community-based services we're talking about.
Sure.
You need to be, you know, there's federal regulations, so you need to be in the community in which you provide the service.
Well, yeah, so you can go over to their house, right?
Yeah, you can't do
telehealth or in-home care.
Yeah, you know, if it snows by you, it snows by them. You know what's going on, right? You have that rapport. You're in the constant communication. And all that was just ripped away overnight.
So on the bottom rung, you have the person who needs services. So they have had somebody coming in and helping them out to do whatever their care profile says. And now who helps them? No one?
So that same person was required to go sign up with this new company, take a cut in pay.
Oh.
They don't pay as much as the previous fiscal intermediaries did. They offered inadequate health benefits, right? They offered MEC plans, which automatically enrolled the employees into a lot of them, and a lot of them already had secondary insurance primary insurance through a spouse or a significant other, what have you. And then they got kicked off of that insurance, and it created a whole entire mess. If you could write down what's the worst possible thing that could happen to an industry, right? I'm going to take over an industry. I'm going to say it's for the benefit. I'm going to cut wages. I'm going to cut benefits. And I am going to monopolize this entire, you know, they look at it as a revenue stream.
Sure. Yeah, because they have hostages. They're all getting old. And they're all in their homes. And either that or they're going to have to go into care facilities.
And they have, you know, I guess good friends, right? Because my organization has been operating in this space for 33 years in New York. We know our communities. I have offices throughout the state that have local workers that show up and know the people that they're taking care of.
Sure.
And that they're talking to. I wasn't eligible to apply for this bid.
Now, why weren't you eligible?
Because in order to be eligible to apply for the bid, you had to be operational outside of New York State.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, considering the program only happens in New York State, right?
And I've been operating in New York State for 33 years. I'm a very well-known, well-respected agency. I've been involved in through all of the associations throughout the state on a very high level. I give back to every community in which I have an office in and work in as much as I can. And it's an ultimate slap in the face. It really is.
Sure.
Saying you're not eligible to help the people which you're currently helping, I'm just going to take it from you like eminent domain.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is an eminent domain. However, they're not required to make you whole before they do it. They just come in and crush your industry.
So your existing clientele then is forced to leave your services and join this conglomerate, basically, and take what they can get.
And his employees are forced to join it too, if they want jobs.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And there's other associations out there that are grassroots community brought up because of this issue, that are still putting on protests to this day outside of the governor's office because their paychecks are incorrect. the systems in which that the company uses do not suit their needs for whatever their disability is. I mean, this is it's absolutely absurd. I'm sorry to use that again, but it is. This company came in, and I don't know if you know how healthcare billing works at all, but typically in any kind of service billing kind of industry, you bill for services which were rendered, and then you get reimbursed net 30, 45 days later, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This company got the bid and was pre-funded 3 months of billing.
Wow.
So in essence, which, bravo to that negotiation, but I could have won the bid, been fronted, because 3 months of billing of $11 billion.
Yeah, right.
I could build you any system in which needs to be built.
Yeah, you could be super creative. You could even drag your feet and take a day off.
Exactly, right? I mean, that's pretty interesting, right? And it's everything, everywhere that you look, it stinks.
Tell me this. So when this all first started, how long ago was that, like, ballpark? I mean, has this been in the works for...
This started, the issue around this industry started under the previous Cuomo administration 4 years ago, where there was a similar RFP issued. However, it was fair. It was challenged legally, mm-hmm. and like so much state contracts is, it was eventually thrown out in court. Because they just didn't feel they didn't have the energy to keep fighting. And so then fast forward to where we are today, that's when Hochul introduced legislation into last year's budget. So, you know, last year's budget, March, April is when we initially found out that this was going to happen. Part of that state Senate committee in which I testified in that you mentioned, the Democratic state senators brought budget legislation that listed the company that won the RFP as legislation before it was changed to be a request for a proposal.
Hmm. So what's the benefit to the state with this new program? I guess we need to look at that.
They're able to control the cash a lot easier since they have one person running it. And so, you know, where that goes from there, you tell me. It's too early to be able to really do any forensic accounting on it, but I can tell you, I'm sure there's some PACs that are very happy. I'm sure that there's some...
yeah, right?
Oh, my gosh. I would imagine with that, because you're talking $1 billion
yeah.
in profits.
What about
the
people who were part of all these services and their families and all that? I mean, what was the pushback on all this?
It was monumental.
I bet
monumental
it was huge.
Monumental pushback. Nobody appreciated. Nobody wanted the change. Nobody asked for the change. Everybody enjoyed the program as it was. We as an industry, through many associations, attempted working with the state, trying to implement our best practices as industry standard and law to reduce everything that they claimed they wanted to reduce, which was fraud, waste, and abuse. You know, that's where they hang their hat.
Sure.
And the best way to do that is, I always felt, would to be work with the, you know, the industry known leaders, you know, to implement these best practices that in which have been proven throughout the industry as audit procedure. Because the audits in which they do...
Well, besides
you
that,
know,
you would have a choice. And I think anyone who has, you know, home health needs, not all of them are the same. And so that allows you to maybe go with a different provider. This takes all of that away. It is now one size fits all. If you have any kind of complaints, well, you know, you're just out.
Yeah, there's no choice. They ripped choice away from the consumer. in April this year for this program.
So you have fewer caregivers. You have, and like so many things, I'm sure the first ones to fall under the axe were your far rural areas in New York, because if you're people who live there, you know, but I don't know, maybe not. They might need the jobs more, so maybe they had to switch over. What kind of happened?
Everyone had
that?
To switch over. I mean, if they were able, they had to switch over. But the sort of the egg on the face for the state is that a lot of these people, you know, switched over to alternate care, more expensive care, more expensive home care, nursing home care, and all of that inflated the cost even more than their anticipated savings that they said that they wanted.
Brilliant.
They moved people into higher acuity care that were happier receiving the care that they were receiving.
Yeah. How many people just bailed on, you know, families had to bail on the in-home care and had to move their relatives into facilities of some kind?
100%. So they have stats on it. In New York, you know, it's anywhere from 50,000 to 80,000 people left for higher acuity care.
Oh, wow. So not just higher acuity in-home, would that mean? I don't necessarily
no.
speak it.
Yeah, higher acuity in-home. It could be higher acuity in-home where instead of having, you know, a family caregiver come in who can administer medication, via traditional home care, that's not an allowable procedure. You can remind medication, but you can't give the medication. And so, you know, if you move from this program to traditional home care, now all of a sudden you need a nurse or an LPN additionally to come into the home to provide that medication.
Yeah, that'll be cheaper.
Right? and so, you know, all of this was done on an executive level. There was no studies done on it. Nobody came and asked the community what would be best. How do we do this? How do we cut costs? No, this was strictly a backdoor deal. And hey, we're the best at doing this. They got sold a bag of goods, which was clearly rotten. And, you know, I have a lawsuit out there against the company that won, and I want to get to the bottom of this. I want to find out. I want to get that discovery in order to get in there and see these emails and prove what I know happens. Because, like I said, I've been in this industry in New York for over a decade, and my company has been providing this service for 33 years. How do you just come in and do this with a company that has never even worked in New York a day in its life?
Yeah. Any chance this will be? How long has it been operational? How long since everybody got the pink slip?
Since April.
So not that long in the scope of all things. Long enough to disrupt the entire universe, but not
correct.
So long that they couldn't go back on it.
Correct. Correct. There's ways, and there is legislation to repeal it and roll it back. But listen, after seeing what just transpired this past budget season, legislation to me is just useless.
Trust me. Everything they want to do in California that's against the law, they just get the voters to go for it. So we only have like a minute left, and I don't want to leave you without first saying we'd love to have a part two, so keep us posted on what happens, because the other part of my question is, how likely is this that more states will do something stupid like this? Because that's usually what happens in your state and ours.
It's highly, highly likely. I mean, we only touched the tip of the iceberg of how deep this spreads. And, you know, how private equity has infiltrated the health system through just staffing, right? Just staffing of these health departments, right?
Sure.
Most of the health departments, you know, countrywide use gap accounting. So they do a lot of subcontracting and staffing agencies to come in to work on, you know, specific projects. And that's how stuff gets infiltrated into, you know, these RFP guidelines that exclude the local provider that cater towards the individual in which they want to win.
Yeah. Oh, and just to decode for people who don't speak acronym, RFP is a request for proposal. I kept meaning to do that.
Sorry.
I was like, oh, after all this, better tell them. Julian, we'd love to have you back on. We have a lot more time, you know. We're not limited to a half hour. So let's talk to Kimberly about setting something up so we can dig into what that part is, because I actually think where we should start next time is, what do you look for in your state to see this train coming down the tracks? Because I think your experience in New York is a harbinger for things coming. So
absolutely is. Absolutely
nice.
Is. Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate
Julian
it.
Julian Heckman, he is with Caring Professionals, Inc. You can find all of the information on our site at wethepeopleradio.us. And we will have him on again for sure. Thanks, Julian. Sorry, I ended the wrong way. Bill was gone for 1 week, and then, well, you know.
So we're going to commercial now.
Yeah, yeah.
Here
so,
we go.
Okay.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw, been in trouble with the law since the day they was born. Straightening the curves, yeah, climbing the hills. Someday the mountain might get them, but the law never will. Making their way, the only way they know how. That's just a little bit more than the law will allow. Stage lights cold as a winter rain. One breath, one prayer, then the world went strange. Crowd froze up when the thunder cracked. Truth on a mic and a life attacked. He talked about hope in a storming land. Bible in the heart and a promise in his hands. But a shadow reached from a coward's perch. Cut down a sun in the middle of church. And I swear if the tables turn the other way, y'all know there'd be fires in the streets today. But here we stand with candles and a folded flag, begging God for mercy on the road we drag. How dare they steal the breath from a faithful. Ain't letting go of your hand.
So, our part two for this hour is John Gordon. And John Gordon is the host of the syndicated radio show, The Truth with John Gordon. He's a graduate of Mercer University Law School in Georgia. He's a business owner and entrepreneur who has also worked as a journalist and a reporter in Macon and Atlanta. He was the Trump-endorsed Republican candidate for Georgia Attorney General in 2022. And right now, instead of being here in the cold and the fog, he lives in Palm Beach, Florida. That's noteworthy here in December. So, Mr. Gordon, what do you have for us today regarding the trial now that we're getting into?
Well, first of all, Merry Christmas to you and your listeners, and it's good to be with you.
Thanks, and Merry Christmas to you as well.
So what is on your mind today?
Well, you know, I saw this from your publicist. The alleged Charlie Kirk assassin Tyler Robinson makes his first court appearance, and all you heard, whether you saw it or not, but all the news was all about how he was smiling and laughing and joking and whatnot. I never was able to actually tune in and watch all that. But
I watched him on the live stream from the courtroom. I did not think he was laughing and being frivolous. I thought he was engaged with his lawyers, having a normal human interaction. So
okay.
I thought those headlines were very exaggerated and bogus. I'll start with saying I think that the circumstantial evidence is probative probative of his innocence. I don't believe that Tyler Robinson killed Charlie Kirk. I do believe he had a role in it. What role he played, I do not know. But I can just tell you this. The information that is coming out of Turning Point USA and the financial questions that have arisen since Charlie's death are very concerning to me. And I don't know. I don't even have a suspicion of what has happened. All I know is that there is a swirl of sketchy stuff surrounding the assassination. I knew Charlie. I had the utmost respect for him. I can confidently say at 72 years old, he is without question the smartest single person I ever met. He was self-educated. He got his college degree online. And he was conversant on any subject. He was faithful. He was patriotic. I think he was an honest person. And the worst thing that you could say about him is that he just simply did not suffer fools lightly.
Yeah.
But he was a father and a husband. And it has hit me hard. I mean, it just sucker punched me in my gut. And the most disturbing thing about it to me, second to his being losing his life, is it seems to me that we have established a new low in this country where political assassination is in the process of being normalized and people are cheering the death of Charlie Kirk. How dare them?
Yeah.
How dare them?
Yeah. Because, well, and of all the people, right? Because his message was always that it was better to talk about it than fight about it. You know, let's hear your ideas. If your ideas win, then your ideas win. But he was the master of, well, let's talk about that some more. And then the person who was just there slinging, you know, BS, you know, kind of blows up in front of the crowd. Which I'm sure was awkward for them, but they kept doing it. You know, it's funny, people couldn't resist.
Well, it almost seemed to be a competition that's on some level of, can you put Charlie in check in one of these verbal banters? And I think it was part sport and part entertainment, but also in his mind, he was doing a service to these students who were being fed wokeism. And he wanted to inject what he considered to be reality in the real world. And I think he did a miraculous job. I first met him in 2017 on the University of Georgia campus. I was there for a fundraiser for then candidate Brian Kemp, now governor of Georgia. And Charlie was there with Don Jr., and they were about to go into an auditorium with 3,000 college kids. And I thought it was very inspirational and very noble of him to have done that. But, you know, he ended up with a big business. I mean, a huge $140 million a year business and an infrastructure and bricks and mortar. So at 30 years old, he accomplished more than I have in 72 years.
And the business end of it, how much do you think the business end of it had to do with his assassination? It kind of sounds like maybe those are connected, or am I misunderstanding?
I don't have evidence to connect the two. What I do know is that there's a lot of smoke from a lot of directions. Candace Owens has done a phenomenal job of highlighting these. She's being... And the thing that really confirms for me that there is something toward that we have not been told is that nobody in Turning Point and in their orbit want to talk about it. And if you do talk about it, you're evil. Now that's disgusting. That here's someone that's close to them, family, his Turning Point family, and close personal friends, and they don't want to talk about it. And Glenn Beck is calling people out if they raise questions. That ought to tell you something. I just don't know what it tells you, except they don't want to talk about it. What are they hiding?
Yeah, that does seem a little bit weird. And the part of the list on what Kimberly had sent for today was what to expect from Tyler Robinson's first in-person appearance. I guess people saw that, and there were a variety of things to be. Because really, I kept hearing about how he was laughing and whatnot, but I never did see it. So you're just saying he was just talking to them, his attorneys. And let's face it, even in the most dire circumstances, God knows I'd be the last one to say there's nothing funny, because there's always something funny in our family.
It was before the proceedings started. He was sitting at the defense table with his lawyers, and he wasn't mocking the proceeding. He was just sitting there casually, calmly having a conversation with his lawyers, and I would think probably trying to relieve their collective tension.
Sure.
The court immediately went into a closed door session that lasted for 2 hours. I think that was probably to consider defense motions about prejudicial optics that made Tyler Robinson look guilty, potentially in their eyes, like that he was shackled, and the position of the camera in the courtroom and geriatrics like that. I promise you, I have no bias. I have no dog in the hunt. The only thing I care about is the truth. But the narrative that we have been fed just doesn't add up on any level. Here's a 19-year-old kid, or maybe he was 23, maybe? No, 19, I think. And he is supposed to have gotten off a 200-yard shot that two expert ex-Navy SEALs independently both said they could not have made. And the heart would have been pumping, the crowd would have been roaring, large presence of law enforcement there. And they just said that combined with the nerves, the pressure of and the seriousness of what he was contemplating, that it would have been nearly impossible.
So the distance, because the distance isn't remarkable.
Well, it's 200 yards. Tell the Navy SEALs that, because they said that scope would have been dancing all over the place if Charlie had been perfectly still, which he wasn't. His head was moving forward and backward and side to side, and they just said that, it's a very difficult shot to have been able to take. That's number one. Number two, AR-15, and I apologize, I derive no pleasure out of saying this, but it would have blown the back of his head off. And there was no exit wound. And you can go on YouTube and watch Dr. Cliff Murchison, something like that. He is a forensic scientist and ammunitions expert. And he said, there's just no possible way that the bone in your neck would have stopped that bullet. There is no exit wound. There are just more questions than there are answers. And to think that this lone guy who happened to be in a trans relationship, how convenient is that? And that he disassembled the gun within less than a minute, sprinted off the roof, ran into the woods and reassembled it and put it on a blanket in the woods. What are we talking about? I can't even say these things without smirking. It just defies logic.
And how much of this, because the other note here is how secrecy and sealed filings could shape the prosecution. So how much of this all is... again, haven't been tracking this a whole lot, but how much of this is all secret?
Well, we have not come close to achieving any level of transparency. I mean, there are so many sketchy things. I gave you a few of them.
Sure.
They drove Charlie past a very large trauma center to get to a clinic that didn't have a trauma center connected with it. There were Google searches from Israel in the days before searching the doctor's name, searching Tyler Robinson's lawyer's name, searching other names that ended up having a connection with the assassination. It's just sketchy as hell. And then Netanyahu, the day after the assassination, says, I didn't do it. Well, I haven't issued a denial, have you? I mean, who does that and why? Charlie was under pressure from the Jewish community because of his questions about the war in Gaza, and he was starting to question the legitimacy of the war. He alleged that there was genocide. He was accosted in the Hamptons at a fundraiser for a Jewish cause, and he was told to back off. They pressured him unbelievably to keep Tucker off the stage at the Turning Point USA convention that they had in Tampa a month before the assassination. And then there's the issue that Candace Owens has highlighted of Saudi jets stalking Erica Kirk. 75 times Erica and this Saudi jet crossed paths, intersected each other at remote places all throughout the world and the United States. So what's that about? And then you've got the reporting that Zach DiGregorio has done on Wolves and Finance, showing that the Turning Point USA 501c4s, that three out of the four failed to make file their tax returns on time. And when he made an issue out of it, the tax returns miraculously got filed. And then that YouTuber, what's his name, that just recently has made a big stir out of this, is calling Candace Owens and people that highlight this as evil. I don't think it's evil to ask questions about why an organization with the kind of money that we're talking about neglected to file their tax returns. Then they file their tax returns, and some 80% of the money that they raised and paid was to a state senator from Arizona. So what is that about?
What was that about?
I don't know.
No one knows? Oh.
I do not know, and I don't allege anything other than there's so much sketchy stuff going on that we need to put sunshine on it and disinfect it. And there may be very reasonable answers to all of this.
Do you think that stuff comes out in this court case?
Well, it depends on whether there's a serious investigation into it or not and where the facts lead. A lot of people don't file their tax returns. A lot of people don't file their tax returns on time. I have been late filing my tax returns, but I always file for an extension, and yeah. I paid the taxes. But just to not even file, and then when they did file, the address was a shopping mall in Tucson. Not Tucson, but not Scottsdale.
Phoenix,
thank you. A shopping center in Phoenix, Arizona with no suite number. And then the Turning Point came back on and said, well, it was to a UPS store with mailboxes that they were using as a place to get the mail.
But they didn't say why they paid the guy or lady. I don't know if it was a man or a woman.
They did not touch it. They made no mention of it at all. It was a guy. And you can go watch it. Wolves and Finance is the podcast, and Zach just does some remarkable reporting. He is a CPA, and he's not a conspiratorialist, but he's a fact checker, I would call him.
Well, everyone knows in finance there's a ton to be had if you actually do some homework. It's funny, the first hour we were sort of talking about this on a completely different level, but same idea. One of the other notes here said that you may be able to address was how early court motions may signal the strength and strategy of both sides.
I have not seen anything that tips a hand one way or the other.
These high-profile things typically look like? I mean, in your estimation, is this what they typically look like?
Well, this is shrouded in secrecy. There has not been a lot that's shared in the public domain. But right now, I think that it's largely a matter of formalities and agreeing on the ground rules, agreeing on, you know, the gag order. The judge said initially that anyone who was a witness or potential witness was prohibited from speaking. And then one of the media outlets filed a motion and asked for clarification, and would that include one of the 3,000 people that were attending the event at the university? Would that mean none of them could speak? And they clarified it and said only people that have been named as potential witnesses could not speak, nor could the lawyers, nor could anyone in law enforcement. That's fairly SOP, but in a case like this, I think that the error should be on transparency, not on secrecy. And there's just too many, there are too many questions. And this act of taking the life of a 30-year-old with as much promise as Charlie had is demonic. You want to talk about evil? That's the evil. Don't for a minute criticize the people that want justice for Charlie. I think that is just wrong on its face.
Yeah. Well, and people, I don't know, you know, we go through these things, and it's a big, big focus for a while, and then it, the next thing takes over. Do you think that that actually, I mean, that's kind of a factor with all of this?
Well, that's clearly what they're hoping will happen. But, you know, John Fitzgerald Kennedy died 62 years ago on November 22nd of this year. That has not gone away. And the difference between Kennedy's assassination and Charlie Kirk's is that we did not have the internet in 1963. I was home from the fourth grade with the flu. I watched the first news flash come out. I guess it was really the second news flash. I watched Walter Cronkite announce that President Kennedy was dead at approximately 1:30 that day. It was the day that I realized that there was real evil in the world. But today we know what happened to Kennedy. The people that did it are no longer here to be held accountable, although I've maintained that we should try them in memoriam and rip their names off the buildings that disingenuously remember them. And I don't think that we should. I think they should be scorned even if they're not here. Tim Pool, by the way, was the podcaster I was trying to remember a minute ago, who just went apoplectic yesterday and was really, I mean, I think he's deserving of a wellness check. He was out of control, and he was spewing venom towards Candace Owens and people like myself who don't buy the narrative and simply want the truth. What is wrong with that? And if you were Charlie's friend, as he professes to be, and I'm sorry, Erica Kirk as well. She's saying you cannot attack my TPUSA family. No one is attacking them. We're asking legitimate intellectual questions that deserve to be answered. When Charlie Kirk, a month before he died, or in the last month of his life, wrote a memo removing his chief operating officer, appointing a new chief operating officer, and calling for a Doge-like forensic audit of the books of Turning Point USA. So let's start with Charlie. He's the one who made us aware of concerns within Turning Point. Let's get to the bottom of the financial problems. I don't know, have you seen the videos of Mikey McCoy when Charlie was assassinated?
No.
Mikey McCoy was his chief of staff. What would you do if your best friend had just gotten shot? I would run and start trying to administer CPR. I was trained to do that in college. What did Mikey McCoy did? He immediately was on his cell phone, turned his back, walked 180 degrees around the back of the stage, and is seen exiting calmly, walking to the parking lot immediately after his boss and alleged best friend was shot and killed. The reaction is unnatural, and it raises serious questions. And I've just given you a few here today. The list is lengthy and they go on. And the American people should demand truth, transparency, and justice.
Wow. Well, don't disagree at all. John Gordon, we must escape because the news is going to overtake us here shortly. What form or fashion it takes is probably not going to have any contribution to what we've been talking about, however, because it's, you know, the news. We will.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you, and I appreciate your giving me the latitude to,
absolutely,
speak and to share the information I've collected.
Very good. And you do a show called The Truth with John Gordon. We have the link up, and you can find all of that at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm always speaking my mind when I'm better off by my tongue. I'm a bad joke at the wrong time. Hell, I'm a legend of my own. Good for some, but I'm not for everyone. Yeah, I'm good for some, but I'm not for everyone.
The second half of We the People Radio. Today is December 14th. We're creeping up on Christmas. 2025, just in case we run this in a different year, as we often do. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And Bill had some firearms information to share with us from the previous program. I was willing him to say something during that, and the time was going by, and Bill was looking annoyed, so...
Well, I was a little bit annoyed. Just 2 points. He said the 200-yard shot was a next to impossible shot, and Navy SEALs told him that, you know, that was a very difficult shot to make. 200 yards is a 10-year-old can make that with a rifle and a scope. That's not that far. And then the second point was... he broke his gun down and ran with it in less than a minute. And it was an AR-15. If anybody knows anything about AR-15, it comes apart with one pin. You can knock it out and stuff it in a bag in probably, I'm guessing, 15, 20 seconds tops. So that point, he didn't know what he was talking about. I'm sorry. We had a little bit more to go, so I didn't want to get to the point where it would hang up on us. But that was pure BS. And I don't know about the rest of the stuff that he was talking about, because I guess I wasn't prepared for that line of information. I am going to do a little more homework on it and find out on some of these things that he was claiming. But anyway, I was a little shocked.
God bless you, the public who is listening, because I would have had to hear about this for the rest of the
day. Please don't think we had him on because we agree with everything he said.
Yeah, we always have that. You never know what goes on. And very rarely do we come back on and say something about the previous. Actually, we've never in 15 years we've never done that.
But I couldn't help it.
But the 200 yard shot that Navy SEALs couldn't make.
Make a 200 yard shot. Yeah, they're no longer Navy SEALs.
They
don't have their names because they don't want to be embarrassed that they can't make a 200 yard shot.
They're busy. They're busy hiding somewhere in a furry costume. Okay. Now I made it weird. Phil, is Phil still on there? Phil's like, oh man, I remember these guys. They're a bunch of kooks. But Phil Kirpin is not a kook. Yay. And we know that because we've spoken with him many, many times. He's a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington, D.C. Don't hold that against him. That's just where a lot of stuff happens. He was the principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity for over 5 years. Previously worked in the Free Enterprise Fund, Club for Growth, and the Cato Institute. He is also a nationally syndicated columnist, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, and author of the 2011 book, Democracy Denied. He is the president of American Commitment, dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free markets, economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom, all of which we super like and promote at all times. So the website there is AmericanCommitment.org. And Phil is chatting with us today about AARP.
Dun, 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 dun. Guaranteed you don't know what's going on.
New report exposes AARP's role in push for massive insurance bailouts amid government shutdown. Yeah, this was in October, but still, we're still fighting about it. So, Phil, the floor is yours.
Hey, great to meet you guys again. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing the amount of money that AARP brings in from United Health in particular. And it even goes back before they had their relationship with United Health in the 90s. They sold health insurance products by Prudential. And when they switched from their exclusive deal with Prudential to their exclusive deal with United Health, it was such a blow to Prudential's health insurance business that they stopped selling health insurance. They're not in the health insurance business anymore. Which is kind of interesting, but they've been with United for a long time, and it just seems to grow larger and larger and larger in terms of the amount of money that it's worth. And we've been tracking this for a number of years, and I think when we first started tracking it, they were skimming 3.95% of all the premiums in the AARP-branded United Health products off the top and sending it to AARP. And then they raised it to 4.95, and we just found in their most recent filings it's now 5.95%. So almost 6% of every premium dollar that's paid in every AARP United Health plan, and that's Medicare Advantage plans, Medicare Supplemental plans, basically 6% off the top gets skimmed, goes right to AARP, and because they call it a royalty for the use of their name instead of a commission, they don't have to comply with any of the insurance rules and regulations, and they've been able to make massive amounts of money this way, and they were making something like $700 or $800 million a year. But then something even stranger happened last year in 2024. They restructured their agreement to include a one-time payment in 2024 of $9.062 billion, which
wow.
is say $9 billion, $62 million, or $9,062 million, however you want to think about it. Over $9 billion with a B in a one-time payment. I don't know what a nonprofit group does with $9 billion. I assume you hire a fleet of investment bankers and they design something that throws off some ungodly amount of income. I've never had that particular problem to deal with myself. $9 billion one-time payment last year, and
wow.
So that year you assume that's I think an advance against their next 10 or 12 years of royalties, whatever it is. I don't know why they wanted a massive advance. It raises a lot of questions no one's bothered to ask AARP or United Health. We've been sort of the only ones pointing to this and how, massive and obscene it is and how does that work with being a nonprofit and so forth. But because of that massive one-time payment, they got 31 times more money from United Health last year than they did in their total membership dues. And so we really shouldn't be surprised that their number one advocacy, and it was during the shutdown, but it's continued through to today, as you said, they're going all out for, we got to extend the supersized Obamacare insurance subsidies. United Health is the second largest recipient of those. And so they are extremely conflicted. And the thing that I find the most outrageous is, if you're taking 6% off the top of all the premiums, you're not negotiating low premiums for your members. You're trying to get the highest premiums you can without losing business, right?
You definitely have a vested
and
interest.
And their premiums have gone up dramatically in those products. I think the AARP Medicare premiums for next year are up 27%.
Oh, wow.
And, that might have something to do with them getting that massive windfall payment, and, hey, let's have a big premium increase, and you'll win and we'll win. And it's, I think, pretty grotesque.
Well, with all of this, why is I've never understood this. There's always all this stuff about AARP. Is it just because people don't look into them that they are still like the major player for all this?
They're a marketing juggernaut. What can I say? They got a great reputation. They fill everyone's mailbox up, and it's a crazy thing because I know a lot of people go to search for a Medicare plan. And they don't go on Medicare.gov. They go on the AARP's website. So what do they only see? They only see United Health plans because they have an exclusive deal with them. And so, they are a juggernaut. And, the challenge is, I can go to elected officials. I can go to elected legislators. I can go to members of Congress. They look at this conflict of interest, look at the amount of money they're getting. And one of the problems is you tell them and they say, wait a second, they have $9 billion. I can't get crosswise with them. They'll destroy me. So, you know, we can shine as much of a spotlight as we want on. They still have the money. That's the problem. That's why it's very difficult to combat them. And they've become very, very tight, in particular, with the Democrats. And, you know, they sort of fused their interest with the Democrats back during Obamacare when Colts and their members were going 14-1 against it, but they supported it anyway. And more recently, with Inflation Reduction Act, we actually did an analysis of this. You know, they've got good lawyers, so they aren't going to say vote for or against this person because of their tax status, but they walk right up to the line. They say, this person's a wonderful hero of seniors, a protector of Social Security, a great and wonderful person, and they do, you know, they run ads and they do town hall events and all this kind of stuff. They do, you know, they do everything but they vote for this person. And they did that for 94 members of Congress, House and Senate, during the Inflation Reduction Act debate, which had, you know, the two-year extension of the supersized Obamacare subsidies and all the other green energy giveaways, all the other things in there. 94 members of Congress, House and Senate, got the full loving treatment for them. 93 of them were Democrats, 93 of the 94. And the one Republican was Mike Crapo from Idaho, who had, like, you know, the Republican from Idaho is not going to lose. And he was going to win by 50 points anyway. And so it was, you know, they're about as partisan as you can get and still claim to be nonpartisan.
Who's actually good? AMAC seems to be the counter, I don't know.
Yeah, I like those guys. I've met with them a few times. I like them. I also like 60 Plus Association, which is the group that Jim Martin and Pat Boone started a long time ago to try to counter AARP. I'm sure there are others as well, but I mean, I just think people need to understand what they're getting when they buy a Medicare plan that has AARP's branding on it. There's a big skim off the top that's going to them, and it's supporting a lot of left-wing causes and Democratic candidates and things like that. And if you're searching on the AARP site, you're not going to see anything else. And so people,
because you're actually
the best
funding
you, and it's got your doctors and whatever. Okay, I can, but understand what you're doing. That's what I tell people.
Because AARP is getting money, even though you're buying a Medicare plan.
From United Health. Yeah, if the AARP name is anywhere on there, they're taking 6% off the top for themselves.
Wow. Why would you even do that? I mean, because you don't know, I'm guessing.
Well, I think a lot of people know that there's a connection.
Because you don't know, or because it's worth it to you, because it's, you know, it's got all your doctors in it or whatever. I mean, look, some people, or some people might say, great, because I love all their advocacy work and I want to support them and whatever. Now, those people are probably not listening to your show, but, you know, somebody might actually like the work that they do. I'm saying that the crazy liberals who like that kind of thing might not be, unless they hate less than, I don't know.
I don't know. There is a guy in San Francisco who's been listening for 15 years who calls us periodically and tries to get on.
Yeah, so you probably have a few of those.
We do have some people living, we are living rent-free in some people's heads. This is the part that I guess is perplexing to me. I'm 65 next year, so it's going to be less perplexing here in about 12 months.
Well, you're going to get so much Medicare marketing, you're not going to believe it.
I'm super excited.
It probably already started. I don't know.
I've been getting a little. But the part I'm looking at is, if you can go get a United, it's not like you can't get a United healthcare plan anywhere else. Like, AARP doesn't. They're not the only access point. Can't you just go to an insurance adjuster and get it?
Their big sort of cash cow, their big sort of most popular policy is what's called Medigap, which is, you know, it's not a replacement for traditional fee-for-service. It's sort of an additional supplement to it. Medicare supplemental coverage, or Medigap coverage is what they call it. And I believe that the only plans United has are the AARP ones. So I do think that it's mutually exclusive.
So if you go to an insurance agent to get Medicare, and I am going to do this. I know a guy. We're going to get somebody on to come and talk to us about Medicare plans and stuff like that, because this whole thing is just like this crazy big mystery. There's so much of it, and it seems like nobody, even the people who have Medicare, don't even know how it really works. Or, I mean, they think it works poorly, and they don't know how to navigate it.
You've got part A that everybody has, and then you got B and C and D, and, you know, I don't think people really take the time to see what each one of those plans cover.
Is that on purpose, Phil? Are they making us confused on purpose, so we'll just go to AARP and push the button?
Maybe. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, look,
we just talked about some conspiracy theories, so sorry, we're just kind of in that mode. we won't rope you into our madness, though. I was curious.
Yeah, you know, Medicare Part A is basically mandatory.
Yes.
It's basically a choice. If you want to turn down Part A, you have to give up your Social Security benefits. So, I mean, basically nobody ever does that, which I think is ridiculous, by the way, because if you're still working and you have employer coverage and you like it, you shouldn't lose your Social Security if you want to keep that instead. I mean, that's a crazy. They should fix that. That should be in one of these healthcare bills.
Well,
I find that insane.
The other part of it is if you don't sign up for it at 65, we've talked about this many times. If you don't at least sign up for Part A, whether you ever use it or not, but if you don't sign up when you're eligible at 65 and you try to do it later, because then you need it, now you're not working or whatever, you're going to pay more forever. They fine you, not just a fine, but the actual monthly rate goes up forever for you, which is brutal. And there's no, I was in a coma when I turned 65. Yep, too bad. You're going to pay more. That fining is something I think should be probably looked at.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, if you got rid of the penalty, then people could keep their employer coverage, which for whatever reason they don't want people to do that. And so I think it's a crazy thing. I think you should be, we should be happy if someone doesn't want it, right? I mean, it would save money for taxpayers.
So you would think.
And why we.
I mean, I've given this example before, but I had a guy who was 89, called and said, I retired with the city of Chicago. My insurance is $4,000 a month now because, you know, they're going broke. And I thought about getting Medicare, so I called him. And if I sign up for Medicare now at 89, my Part A is going to be $4,300 a month.
Hmm.
I was like, what? Like,
yeah.
How long are you going to live when you're 89? Really? But $4,300 a month? Are you kidding? He goes, so imagine that. My coverage through my retirement in Chicago at $4,000 a month is actually a deal.
It's actually cheaper. That's crazy. That's
is that
wild.
Nuts? So when people say, well, I'm probably not going to sign up for it when I'm 65, I'm like, no, do it.
Yeah, you're going to sign up. I mean, that would be a mistake, yeah. I mean, the way it's set up now, you have to, basically.
Yeah, you do have to. So talk to us about this subsidy thing that we can't seem to get away from.
Let me sort of give you the whole story on that.
Oh, wait, hold on. I'm blowing it, Phil. Alex, can you just, like, play something? I forgot. We have to have real breaks this hour. We were all screwed up last hour. Let's take a really quick break, and when we come back, then my question is still the same. How's that?
Sounds good.
Poor Phil. You caught us on a really weird week. All righty. You're listening to We the People. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Your size, just when I think I'm gonna get away. I hear those words that you always say. Abracadabra, abracadabra. I wanna reach out and grab ya. Abracadabra. Abracadabra.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Hey, teacher, leave them kids alone.
Sorry about that. I wasn't as quick on the draw.
I like it.
Yeah.
We are another brick in the wall, even when you're 65. Things don't change. Like when you're a kid, you think, "Oh, when I grow up, I'm gonna be in charge of everything. Nobody's gonna boss me around." And then
you find out you have more bosses.
And then that all goes away. So Phil, we can't stop hearing about this stupid, you know, the
subsidies,
Subsidies, and blah blah blah. And so there are a lot of people that aren't involved in this, and they're weary of it. There are people who are involved in it. They're being, you know, ramped up every 5 seconds. So what is the Phil Kirpin breakdown on this situation for us?
All right. So when Obamacare was originally passed, the structure of the subsidies for people who are in the basically the healthcare.gov or the equivalent state exchange for the states that run their own, like your state, the subsidies were based on this structure where you had to pay a certain percentage of your income on a sliding scale, and then taxpayers would pick up the rest, up to 400% of the federal poverty level. That was the income cap at the top end. And at the bottom end, for people who were very poor, under 150% of the federal poverty level, it was 2% of income. So basically, if you're under 150% of poverty, you pay 2% of your income, which was like $5 a week or something like that, and then taxpayers picked up the rest. And then that percentage went up until it got to about 8%, and then above 400% of the poverty level, there was no subsidy. So above that, you're expected to pay your own way. Taxpayers don't pay for it. That structure was changed during COVID. They said, oh, my God, it's a COVID emergency. We need to throw way more money at subsidies or else people won't. I mean, there actually was not much logic why COVID meant they needed to do this. But they used it as the excuse. They said, no, because this is a pandemic, we need to change the structure. And in particular, the two biggest changes they made, they increased the subsidies kind of throughout the subsidized range. But the biggest changes they made were at the top and the bottom. At the top, they said, we're getting rid of the income limit completely. So there's no income limit at all. Instead, there's going to be an 8.5% is the maximum that anyone has to pay towards premiums in Obamacare, and everything above that taxpayers will pick up. So even if you're super rich and you're making $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 a year, if you're in a place where the insurance premiums are more than 8.5% of that, then taxpayers are going to pick up the rest, that's the 8.5%. So they have literally no income limit at all at the top. And what they did at the bottom end, they said instead of 2% of your income, we're going to make it exactly zero, $0. Taxpayers are going to pay 100% of the premiums for anyone who's under 150% of the poverty level. And then, miraculously, millions and millions of people, more than the total number that exists with incomes below 150% of the poverty level, signed up and got Obamacare for a zero cost with taxpayers picking up the full freight. So fraud just went through the roof because when you don't have to pay anything, what we learned is somebody will sign up and claim a benefit in your name so that, you know, an unscrupulous broker can get a commission, so an unscrupulous insurance company can get premiums, or just people who aren't going to use it and don't care. Somebody asks them to sign up, they sign up, but because they pay zero, they don't file any claims. And so we got millions and millions of people who signed up. In many cases, they're probably fictional, and who don't file any claims, but taxpayers are paying a fortune out in commissions and in premiums. And so those are the big changes, that the no income limit and cutting the premium to zero at the bottom end. And originally they did it for 3 years, then they extended it for 2 more years in the Inflation Reduction Act, and now it expires at the end of this year. And, you know, the fraud is staggering. I'm not going to go on too much, but I will say the Government Accountability Office just did a report on the fraud in the Obamacare exchanges. They did a couple of experiments. In 2024, they signed up 4 fake people that they invented with fake Social Security numbers. All 4 were accepted, and
great.
Subsidies were paid out in their name. And in 2025, they said, let's try 20 fake accounts that will sign up. 18 of them got approved, and the premium subsidies flowed. One of them was actually rejected. And one of them, the broker stopped getting back to them. So that one's sort of an incomplete. But 18 out of the 20, or 18 out of the 19, if you don't want to count the one where the broker flaked on them, no problem, approved. And then they did an analysis of Social Security numbers for 2023, which is the last year they had complete tax records. And they sort of bumped the Social Security numbers in Obamacare up against the tax returns that were filed in the IRS data, and they found that 32% of subsidy recipients, so basically a third of subsidy recipients, use Social Security numbers that could not be reconciled with tax records, even
what?
Though if you get the subsidies, you're supposed to be required to file a tax return. That totaled $21 billion in that 1 year of not reconcilable Social Security numbers. And they found, I think these are right, just off the top of my head, so it might be a little wrong, but it's pretty close, 66,000 Social Security numbers were being used by more than one person. They found thousands that were being used, of dead people's numbers that were being used. And my favorite is there was one Social Security number that was being used by 71 different people to get Obamacare benefits.
Holy
and,
cow.
Were they all in Michigan?
That, kind of like, how are these people not famous? How have they not been arrested? Where's the front page story? And then here's the thing that's most insane to me. So the Democrats see this report, which just came out like 2 weeks ago, and then you know what they say? They say, well, we're going to extend this for 3 more years with no changes, with no fixes, with no anti-fraud measures. They,
because
they
we have to, because
like, yeah,
otherwise people will be hurt.
Okay, no problem. Yeah, they're like, hey, no problem. We don't need to change a thing. Let's extend this with no changes at all. And they voted, I believe, every single Democrat in the Senate voted to, and 4 Republicans voted to extend it 3 more years
Good
with
Lord.
No fixes and no changes. So, I mean, I think this is one of those things where, you know, they've discovered it's a good political talking point, and you know, they don't care that it's being abused massively.
And in those cases where all this was paid out, there's no way they're going to get any of that back, even if they find out who the people were that fraudulently claimed. They obviously don't have any money, or they wouldn't be doing this. But maybe some of them did have money.
Well, I mean, the insurance companies, I think, should have to pay it back, or somebody. I mean, look, there should be some mechanism. I don't know. I mean, look, it's a ridiculous thing, because if you look at what insurance company stocks have done since Obamacare passed, they're basically vertical. I mean, they're up like thousands of percent.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, what do we do this for? Why are we enriching them? The quality of care has gotten down. Affordability is worse than ever. And the other thing that I, you know, the biggest trend, which I find so destructive since Obamacare passed, is physicians' practices are just being gobbled up left and right by hospital systems,
yep.
by private equity, and just it's become almost impossible anymore to just be a doctor and run a practice. I mean, we've gone from, I think it was about 15% corporate ownership of physicians' practices before Obamacare to 60% plus now and rising rapidly. We've got these massive, and by the way, these massive hospital systems, most of them are nonprofits. So when they buy everything up, they take them off the property tax roll too, which puts pressure upward on everyone else's property taxes. I just think it's a horrible, horrible trend. We've got less choice and competition than we've ever had before in healthcare. Prices are going up, and you know, all they want to talk about is, you know, how much more government money are we going to throw at it instead of trying to actually get back to having a functioning marketplace with actual competition and choice and supply. I mean, we've got such limited supply, and you know, these hospital systems have just become massive, massive bureaucratic monsters.
Yeah, and it really disincentivized people going into medical school, you know. It's like,
yeah, and the ones who do, but also the ones who do, they don't even think about starting a practice anymore. It's
right.
Which hospital system are you going to join?
Right. Or specialty. Specialty seems to be doing okay, but...
Yeah, well, even those mostly have affiliations, though, with the system. It's
yes, they do.
It's rare to find an independent one anymore. So it's the same thing is happening there, although you're right, I think less so. But it's, you know... It's been a very destructive trend. I mean, and I think we need to, you know, I keep telling Republicans this, like, be more ambitious. You know, the Speaker put out this slide of these are the things we want to do, and it had all these great things on it that I've been wanting for a long time. It had things on there like, you know, repeal the ban on physician-owned hospitals, which was something that was in Obamacare that doesn't get enough attention, which has been, you know, ridiculous. And it had a bunch of things on that list that were great, you know, big HSA expansions, but also things on the supply side, like physician-owned hospitals, like, the insanity of federal payment policies. You know that if a physician's practice gets bought by a hospital system, immediately the next day, every visit to the same doctor in the same office gets paid more by Medicare than they did when it was an independent physician, because now it's considered part of a hospital system. It gets paid at a hospital rate. So So we have these, we have payment incentives and we have regulatory barriers that have just forced everything in this direction. They were going to take that on. He had that on his slide. He had a list of all these things. And then their bill comes out, it's got none of that. It's, you know, it's fine. The things that are in it are fine. They're directionally good, but they're so modest compared to, you know, the more aggressive things they were talking about. So I really think the Republicans suffer a huge lack of ambition on health care.
And how much of it is that they can't get it through the system? I mean, they could.
Yeah, that's probably part of it. I mean, look, how do you ever take on these hospital systems now that they've become the largest employers in most congressional districts? It becomes very hard.
Yeah, it does become very, very, very difficult. And then these sorts of changes, when you wipe out the marketplace factor on anything, especially insurances, because we're seeing that with, you know, fire insurance and that sort of thing out here. As soon as you screw up the marketplace for that kind of thing, putting that back in place takes time. I mean, they don't have the actuarials. They don't know if they want to compete in that market. They've got to get the plans drawn. You've got to push them out. You have to give people time to, you know, to look at them and apply for them. I mean, that isn't something that happens. You pass a bill today and your plan's available next week. There's no way to turn that corner.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're in a pretty deep hole, so it's going to be pretty difficult to dig out of it. There's no question about that. Look, I mean, some places actually are worse than you do. At least California doesn't have one of the most restrictive certificate of need laws, but like a lot of states. You know, a lot of states, you cannot open a hospital or a surgical center or a clinic unless you get permission from the incumbent hospital system to let you compete with them.
What?
Think about that. Yeah, they call it a certificate of need. You have to prove there's a need for it, and the incumbent can object.
Wow.
Half the states still have that.
So much for competition.
But one of the things I've been calling for is, you know, Congress should preempt that. I mean, that's a huge barrier nationally to healthcare supply being built.
When did that come in? Was that an Obamacare thing?
No, that's much older. That was a Ted Kennedy thing. I want to say it started in the 70s, and they actually forced every state to adopt it, and then they repealed it in the 80s, but a lot of states never repealed it. So it's sort of the feds forced them to take it, and then a lot of states never got rid of it.
No kidding. Well, I do know that in a lot of our rural areas out here anyway, if you are the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services put out, and it's been like 20 since, I don't know, was it 2017, I think, mileage requirement. If you're within this certain mileage circle from a facility that can do that, then you're not eligible to be part of that system. And so we have some of our rural hospitals, small hospitals, closing or emergency facilities closing, and everyone's blaming it on the bill at the first of the year. It's like, well, actually, it started back in 2017. Where does that fit into all this madness, or is that just a separate self-inflicted wound?
Yeah, I don't know too much about that. They might be able to apply federal funds. There is a new $50 billion Rural Hospital Stabilization Fund that was in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, so I don't know.
This doesn't have anything to do with it. Like, there's one here. It's a 30, I'm going to get it wrong, I forget. It's like 32 miles or something like that. If you're within a critical care facility and you're within that 30-mile radius, then you are not eligible for that that funding, which means basically you can't stay open. But the circle that they draw, like in one particular instance, the road is flooded. The 30 miles, you can only make it there in 30 miles if you take
you
this
helicopter.
Kind of
yeah.
back road, and it's flooded. But if you go like the way that ambulances would go and that kind of thing, it's actually longer. But because you could get there in a shorter distance, even though it's only part of the year, they still are closed. I'm like, oh, wow. That's just painful. I mean, there's still a lot of our medical stuff. We are just making painful decisions that will have long-term impact. I want to go back. We have to take another quick break, but when we come back, I want to go kind of back to this Obamacare thing and how much of it is still there because we've taken parts of it out. the big repeal of it seems not to be possible. I'd kind of like to go back and have you unravel some of that for us so we know what we could be looking at, should be looking at, and what's really basically the ship has sailed. Our guest is Phil Kirpin. His organization is AmericanCommitment.org. You can find them online. You can also find them on our website at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry. Be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the diamond. Sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor.
I like that song. It's funny to me. Okay. So the Democrats are thinking, don't worry, be happy. You can just have Obamacare and like it. But I got to know, Phil, we all think, I mean, using the term we loosely, obviously, but we all think that, honestly, when they passed Obamacare, they knew it was going to fail. They did it on purpose because they thought they could walk us into a single-payer system when it blew up in our face.
Yeah, look, a lot of people think it was on purpose. I don't know. I mean, it probably was for some of its supporters, but I'm generally a big believer in what they call Hanlon's razor, to never attribute to malice what can be explained by incompetence, especially when it comes to government. And so I think a lot of them just, you know, oh, you know, let's try this. I think it'll work. And then, you know, it's a disaster.
But yeah, never.
Actually implementing these things is very difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, and look, I mean, there's the fundamental conceit behind every government policy, which is, you know, where politicians and bureaucrats can allocate resources as efficiently or more efficiently than individuals making their own choices and decisions. And, you know, that's why every form of central planning fails, because they can't. It doesn't work, but doesn't mean they don't believe they can.
Right? Yeah, true.
And so, you know, I think, because if you knew it was going to fail, you would also know single payer is going to fail even worse, right? Because you would know the reason it's going to fail.
But they have this magical joyride in their mind of what single payer will be. And I'm like, you know, you should look at like VA and some of that and Medicare and blah, blah, blah. It's not all that great. But honestly, we talked about repeal. Repeal didn't happen. Then we've gotten rid of some pieces of it. We've restructured chunks of it. Now it's kind of just all over the place. I mean, are we just going to have to deal with it bit by bit at this point?
Well, you know, the big thing we repealed was the mandate, the individual mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we went from, you know, here's this horrible thing and you're going to be punished if you don't buy it, to here's this horrible thing and you won't be punished if you don't buy it, except you kind of will be punished because if you don't have employer coverage, what are you supposed to do, you know? I mean, so it's an improvement, but it's not a great improvement. And so I don't know that we've accomplished anything particularly notable in the effort to reform this law. It would be nice if we Republicans could just not extend these supersized subsidies with no limits and no minimum payments at the bottom end and massive fraud and all of that. And so, I mean, check back with me, you know, in a couple of months, and I'll tell you, you know, whether we accomplished something at least at dialing it back to the original structure from this expanded structure. But not much. Other than getting rid of that mandate, not much has really been accomplished. And, you know, I think there's an appetite for it, honestly, especially if we really focus on the supply side, which is what I've been trying to convince Republicans of, is, you know, talk about making it easier for doctors to be in independent practice. Talk about making it easier to open clinics and to open ambulatory surgical centers and to open up, you know, to have more competition, to bring back physician-owned hospitals, to have,
you know, have more supply, have more choice, have more medical services that are available to people, and also, you know, fix the payment side also so people can control their dollars and expanded agencies and stuff like that. But if all you do is talk about the financing and, you know, how the insurance side is structured, you're not going to accomplish much, and you're not going to, I think, have a winning political message.
Don't you, if they were to get rid of the subsidies, wouldn't that inspire more competition with the insurance companies? Because there'll be a lot of people that'll have to start shopping for policies. And to capture that market, I would think they'd have to be more competitive. Because all you hear is if they get rid of the subsidies, everybody's going to lose their insurance. It's going to get more expensive, blah, blah, blah. Wouldn't just the opposite happen?
Well, remember, we're talking about the enhanced subsidies, the supersized subsidies. The original subsidy structure is still very generous. I mean, taxpayers are still going to be picking up some 80% of all the premiums for people who are in Obamacare plans, even if this expires, down from, you know, the 93% it is now, or 94% or so. And so there's still a lot of subsidy. But what you do by bringing the income back, income cap back in particular, is now you've got some downward pressure on prices for exactly the reason you said, because now instead of everyone, no matter how much money you make, having subsidy eligibility, now everyone who's over 400% of federal poverty level is paying out of their own pocket, and so you can't sell the policies unless there's a customer who's willing to pay,
right,
or you only have people who are subsidized. And so I do think that bringing the income limit back will put some downward pressure on premiums. The other thing I'd really like to see them do is they really need to repeal this regulation called the medical loss ratio regulation. And this was part of Obamacare that said that insurance companies have to pay out 80% of every dollar they bring in claims. And they said, oh, this will prevent them from profiteering and trying to keep some absurd amount of money from them. But what it actually does in practice is they want to pay more in claims. They want costs to keep growing out of control for hospital services, because that's the only way they grow their revenue, right? So, you know, they can raise the premiums and bring more money in, but in order for them to keep that money, they've got to figure out a way to pay it out in claims. And so they actually want the underlying costs of services to continue to rise. Or the other thing they do is they do a lot of self-dealing. And so, you know, they've all the insurance companies now bought their own pharmacy division. So, like, United owns Optum, and, you know, and you've got all the other insurance companies have their own PBM pharmacy divisions, so like, you know, like the CVS and so forth. And so, you know, what happens is they don't really have any incentives for cost containment. What they're trying to do is maximize claims and maximize how much they get paid, because that's the only way that they can retain earnings. And so we don't have a well-functioning market, and changes to insurance, including bringing back an income cap in some form, can certainly help with that. And, you know, I do think there are a lot of things we can fix on the demand side. I just think the supply side is more urgent, in my opinion, and so that's got to be a big part of the message, especially to not just to be successful substantively, but to be successful politically, because I think people can relate to how the dwindling supply of competitive services and the fact that these giant hospital systems are gobbling everything up. I think that's a message that the Democrats are, you know, normally the Democrats would bash big corporations and that kind of thing, but because I think everyone kind of knows that their policies have driven this, they've not really been able to seize that opportunity, and it's there for Republicans, I think.
It just seems like it just keeps getting more complicated, and it's not only difficult to fix, but it's difficult to get people on the same page, and I think because it's just so confusing, and the public doesn't understand it. How many people do you think, not individuals, but how sweeping an impact will it be if they don't continue these subsidies? They make it sound like no one's ever going to be able to go to the doctor again. And we all know that's
true. We're already well into the open enrollment period for Obamacare plans. And right now, when people go on and they look at the prices and they look at what's available, they see the prices with the regular subsidies, the original Obamacare subsidy structure, because the expiration is currently the law. And yet enrollment is running ahead of last year, not behind. And so, you know, look, we'll see at the end. The enrollment period ends January 15th. If Congress hasn't extended the subsidies, you know, we'll see if people are right about the number of enrollees going down by millions. But I tend to doubt that's going to happen because enrollment right now is running ahead of what it was last year, which I think underscores the point that the subsidies are still very generous without the enhancement. It's just now you've got some income limits, and now, you know, people who are poor are paying, you know, they're paying $5 a week or whatever it is. They're paying 2% of their income rather than paying zero. And so, you know, it's not, you know, the way it's being portrayed and the way it's being reported on is as if all the subsidies are about to go away. And that's
right.
Not true at all. The subsidies, the original permanent Obamacare subsidies are pretty generous. It's just this COVID-era enhancement that's expiring. And so I think the impacts are greatly exaggerated. I think, you know, there is a group of people that will be hit hard by this. It's the group of people that really benefited from the expansion, and we know who that is. For the most part, that's early retirees who are not 65, but they're in their, you know, let's say they're 62, 63, 64, and they retired early, and they've got substantial retirement income that would price them out of getting Obamacare subsidies, but because the income cap was eliminated, they're able to get large subsidies, and because they're old, their Obamacare plans are expensive, and they probably use a lot of health care, and they're getting taxpayers to pick that up for them. And, you know, I can understand why people would say this is horrible. I planned around this being there, and I retired early because I thought this would be there. And, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if Congress tried to do something to address that specific group of people. But the thing is, they're sort of exploiting these emergency COVID-era supplements in order to retire early and in order to not have to pay for their health care for the few years before they get into Medicare. And so on the other hand, if Congress doesn't do anything for them, you know, they took that risk. They knew those subsidies were temporary. They knew they weren't permanent when they decided that. And so, you know, you can sort of say, okay, they took that risk and it didn't work out for them, or at least, you know, for a couple of years before they get into Medicare. And so that's really the group that is hit hard. Most of the examples that the Democrats have come up with of, you know, people that are going to be, they're going to see their payments go up a lot because they lose the subsidy enhancement, most of them are actually not very sympathetic because they're generally high-income people who could pay without the subsidies. And so, you know, they're pushing all these headlines and these scare tactics, but most of them rely on sort of the sleight of hand of pretending that all of the subsidies are expiring instead of just the enhancement.
And that's really important because that message is absolutely not being delivered. It's making it sound like you have, you know, the single mom with three kids who's, you know, working nights and, you know, and all of a sudden now they're all going to be out of pocket on everything. And that's just not factual.
Yeah, correct. I think it's a lot of deliberate deception because the Democrats see this as a huge political opportunity for them, and they've got the media in their back pocket. And so I think the reporting on this has been deliberately very deceptive.
Nice.
And I mean, how can you say nobody's going to be able to afford it if enrollment's running ahead of last year? I mean, I think that's a big problem, but, you know, it's not being represented.
So we only have like 3 minutes left. I want you to go back to the supply of physicians, specifically general practitioners. I realize we have shortage with almost everything, and it's really across the country, regardless of, you know, whether you live in a city or rural or whatever. Some places are hit a little bit more than others, but how do you see us increasing supply in that particular group?
Well, I mean, I think...
I mean, what, you know, could, what could we get rid of, like, policy-wise that's actually killing us in kind of in order? Like, what's the first thing we should ditch or institute?
Well, I mean, look, I think that we should repeal the ban on physician-owned hospitals. We should repeal or reform the Stark Law, which makes it so the doctors can't own their own MRI machines and other types of equipment.
Why can't they do that? What was the whole point of that?
Because then they get busted for self-referring people. Even though if you're a hospital system, you can self-refer all day long. So they've got that sort of asymmetry in the federal law. I would preempt the state certificate of need laws, which are a huge supply barrier in most states, although, as I said, not yours. shockingly, one of the few things where California doesn't have the dumbest law. I'm proud of that.
Okay, hold on. Yay! That's about all I got.
Yeah, I mean, but I also think, you know, look, the federal government created a lot of this with the moratorium on medical schools. They had a medical school moratorium that was on for, I don't know, a couple of decades anyway. I think it was 1980 to 2000-something. There was a federal moratorium on medical school seats because they were worried about a, quote, physician surplus. And it just tells you how insane it is to have, you know, federal government involvement in things like this, trying to decide how many of some profession we're going to have. And we should never do anything like that again. And we should do the opposite. You know, we should peel back the barriers to starting new medical schools, to expanding them. I would strongly consider scaling from a four-year MD program down to three. I think it could be done, and it would improve the attractiveness of going into that line of study if you could get out of school a little bit earlier. And I think there are a lot of things we could think about. But you know, I also think we need to have litigation reform, because the cost of carrying
malpractice
has become prohibitive for independent practitioners. One of the reasons that they get driven to be acquired or to go into a different line of business in the first place. And so, you know, I think that would make a big difference. But I think, you know, really, just in general, we need to lower the regulatory burden so that, you know, you don't need to have a whole compliance division, an accounting division to deal with government bureaucracies and insurance company bureaucracies. So it would make it a lot easier to have direct pay practices. And part of the payment reforms can also help with the supply side too, right? If people all have HSAs and they can subscribe to a doctor or to a physician, if you could get your primary care doctor for a monthly subscription fee that covers everything, and a lot of people are already doing this.
And they are kind of doing that.
Tax advantage dollars, and they didn't have to worry about dealing with insurance or government. A lot more people would probably go into that business.
I bet they would. Phil Kirpin, it has been magical having you on for this hour. We appreciate it. You can find the archive of this free to listen to and uninterrupted at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay. We got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.